Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. In today's episode, I met up with Rachel Kauser to talk about her book, Alexander at the End of the World, The Forgotten Final Years of Alexander the Great, published by Mariner Books in July 2024. This interview was recorded on May 2nd, 2024, in New York City. Rachel Kauser, welcome to Bio. Alexander the Great needs no introduction. He's been studied for millennia. What were your goals in writing about someone who has become a legend?
Thank you so much for having me. It's wonderful to be here. I'm super psyched. It is true. Arrian, one of his biographers in the 2nd century CE, said, "There are already too many biographies." And then he wrote one. There's a long tradition of people writing about Alexander, thinking about Alexander. And I did wonder at the beginning, you know, what is it that I'm going to be contributing? And I would say there are two main things that were important to me. One was to focus on his final years, because I feel like most people talk about this sort of effortlessly successful young king. And to me, the really exciting part is when the going gets tough and when his empire, in essence, strikes back. And that's what creates his world historical legacy. That's what makes him, shows the measure of who he is. So I wanted to focus on that. And the other thing that's different, I think, about what I'm doing is that I'm coming at this. I have a background in classics. So I did Greek and Latin in high school and college. I did lots of history. But I've also trained as an art historian and archaeologist. And that gave me a different perspective, because while the written sources have been very important to me, I can supplement them with a lot of material that most historians of Alexander don't talk about, which is the archaeological traces of where he went, what he did. What this does for us is to give us a better sense of what's going on around Alexander. And particularly, I was interested in sort of like, how was the conquest experienced by the conquered? I feel like archaeology would allow us to do more of that.
You open this book with Alexander's invasion of Persepolis in winter-spring of 330 BCE. At this point, he's in search of the great king Darius, who has fled. Why did you choose to begin your book with this scene?
So to me, Persepolis is a real turning point, because over the course of the past just over 3 years, he's managed to essentially create what is the first European empire in the Middle East. And I think at this point, I should say first, he was 25. Crazy, right? I think at this point, a lot of people expected him to just kind of cash in and go home. And instead, he keeps going east. He wants to get to the borders of the Persian Empire in what's now kind of Central Asia, Afghanistan, South Asia. He maybe wants to get to the end of the world, which he believed he would find back there.
The end of the world is what exactly?
So for the Greeks, they had this idea at the time of Alexander that the world was, kind of imagine a donut. In the center of it is the Mediterranean Sea, and then there's land all around it, but then there's outside that, there's an outer ocean that's empty. And that's what he was hoping to get to, the ocean at the end of the world, which he, I think, partly was interested in sort of as a scientific hypothesis, but also partly just that would be an obvious place to stop. And it was hard for him, a very driven person, to find another one.
So then you describe in great detail the pillage and burning of Persepolis, the way they left in such a hurry that they left very specific valuables behind. How were you able to paint such a vivid picture in such specificity?
Thank you. I benefited tremendously from evidence that most historians haven't looked at, which is that Persepolis is a very well-preserved archaeological site. Rather ironically, because Alexander burned it down in 330, it has never been substantially re-inhabited. So now it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and it was excavated quite thoroughly and for the time really well in the 1930s by a team from what used to be called the Oriental Institute of Chicago. And they published these three really big, kind of unwieldy volumes in the early 50s, which are wonderful and tremendously detailed, particularly because Persepolis was the site that had been sealed. So you could really see like what he left and what wasn't there. And so reading that, it was very clear to me that there was a lot of evidence that hadn't really been mined for what he did, that you could trace even things like the bits of stuff that his soldiers were trying to loot and dropped on the stairs. I mean, micro history in a really fascinating way. And that was one of those moments where I was like, oh, this is what archaeology brings to us.
To what extent did you travel to these places?
I started out by going to London and Paris because as the sort of big colonial powers of the 19th and 20th century, a lot of material from Central Asia, South Asia, Iran, etc. was there. And I also made contact with the French archaeologists who were the last people to work in Afghanistan, one of the centers of my research, before the Soviets came in. We're still there, still working. And I was planning on going to see some of their excavations in Uzbekistan and hoping to set up a trip in the spring of 2020. Well, you know how that turned out. So, ironically, I spent the next year and a half writing about a guy who was trying to get to the end of the world from a small corner of northern Manhattan. I benefited tremendously from, above all, some truly amazing ILL librarians from the Graduate Center at CUNY and from the New York Public Library. At one point, they were even like literally mailing research books to scholars at our homes in the middle of the pandemic. I mean, it was, they went so above and beyond. It was amazing and it was wonderful. But I really at that point realized I was going to have to write the book without getting to Persepolis, without getting to Samarkand, without getting to many of the places I had hoped to make it to, because I just wasn't sure when I was going to be able to go there.
Do you plan on going there?
Fingers crossed. I think Iran is probably not a great option right now. But I think I'm hoping at some point to get to Uzbekistan for sure, because he spent a lot of time there. In some ways, he faced some of the worst or the most challenging fighting of his career in that area. And I would love to go. It looks beautiful and fascinating.
Well, when you go, I can't wait to read that article in the New York Times or wherever it ends up. Alexander made choices that he regretted, such as burning Persepolis to the ground and killing his friend during a drunken brawl. What sources did you use to glean this insight?
That's a very good question. So although I'm an archaeologist and I used a lot more archaeological material than, you know, many historians of the period had done, I did also very much rely on written sources. And they have their limitations because most of them were written down about 300 years after, or the ones that we have were written down about 300, the earliest or 300 years after. So it's like writing a biography of George Washington if you didn't have anything that was written before 2000. Just imagine that one. But they were relying on earlier memoirs. It seems like everybody who was remotely associated with Alexander, rather like recent presidents, like wrote a memoir afterwards, a tell-all. So they had, people like Plutarch, had those to rely on, and they give us a fairly good sense of at least the big issues in his career. I really tried to be thoughtful about the difference between being able to say what I knew he knew at a particular time and what he thought, because I felt like there were times when I would love to have been able to say, oh, he was feeling this. But there were a lot of moments where I was like, I don't think I can do this. Like, I can tell you how he acted and how people observed that he acted, like when he killed his friend and, you know, refused food and drink for 3 days. So I feel like it wasn't going out on a limb to say he was regretting that one. But at the same time, I felt like there were other moments where I really wanted to be careful and not try and psychoanalyze him.
Women are often written out of history. How were you able to get details on Alexander's mistress or his wives and other women in this biography?
One of the reasons, honestly, that I was so interested in doing this biography was because it's like with Alexander, the spotlight is so intense on him. That he was so famous from the time he was alive to ever since that it illuminates countless people who otherwise would be lost to us, right? Because ancient writers, most of whom are these powerful men, would not have considered it important. But when they impinge on Alexander's life, when he marries them, when he has children with them, when he captures them, etc., we do get these critical bits of information about these women. So I use that. But then I also really tried to use things like archaeological evidence for how Persian women dressed, say, or what kind of education they had, or their role as landowners. So for which we have actually a lot of interesting cuneiform records. So I was able to sort of put all of that together to try and give a much better understanding of these people who were so important in their own time, but whose lives have been so neglected since then.
How did Alexander unify his empire of Macedonians, Egyptians, Greeks, and Persians?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and one that I think he struggled with and is a struggle for any large heterogeneous empire. I think the first thing to recognize about Alexander is he didn't try too hard to impose a kind of one-size-fits-all system. In Egypt, he was perfectly happy to be crowned as pharaoh and treated as a pharaoh and to work with native Egyptian priests, whereas in Greece he presented himself, or in the Greek cities of Turkey, he presented himself as the liberator from the Persian king, the liberator of the Greeks. So he really tried to kind of navigate each cultural group on its own terms, but he did at the same time do a number of things that seem very intentionally integrative. So, for example, every time he conquered a new group of people, he integrated some of them into his army. So by the end, he had Phoenician sailors, but he also had archers from Crete. Apparently, Crete had the best archers. And he had Scythians. They're these guys with like tattoos and baggy pants and a lot of jewelry from northern steppes culture, and they were amazing on horseback as archers. So he had them, and he must have had this kind of United Nations of an army by the end, and that was really a kind of testing ground for trying to integrate and have people work together. It didn't always go easily. I think there were a lot of tensions, cultural tensions, religious tensions, etc. But I think he was able to do it, and it was important to him to try.
So what can we learn today about Alexander the Great's leadership?
Here we are in an election year, and we're thinking a lot about what makes a good leader. What should our leaders look like? The thing that I found most impressive about Alexander was what I would call his kind of creative resilience. A lot of times when a political leader runs into opposition, what they do is kind of double down. They push back, they fight back, and they keep doing the same thing harder. And one of the things that I found most interesting about Alexander was his ability to be like, try something out, didn't work, and then he would try something totally different and keep trying and learn through failure in this very creative way, which I thought made him a much more effective military leader, but also political leader. For example, at one point, he is trying to convince his army that they need to keep going east. He's in what's present-day Pakistan, far from the borders of the Persian Empire, like well beyond them. And he wants to just keep on going. And his soldiers are finally like, you know, had enough. And so he gives them this big speech about how wonderful it will be and how much they have to conquer. And they're just like, no, we're not doing this. And he gets really mad and stalks out. And then he waits. He sort of waits to see what they're going to do. They are waiting to see what he's going to do. And they do not back down, even though he's the king. And finally, after 3 days, he's like, well, and he goes and makes a sacrifice. And the priests say that the omens to going forward are very unfavorable. And he's like, okay, the gods are against me. Guess we will have to go home. So it's this interesting moment where he could have tried to suppress this questioning of his authority with force, but instead he kind of maneuvers. And he maneuvers to get his own way a bit too, because he then decides to go not directly back west, which is maybe what they're thinking he should do, but instead to go south and see ocean after all.
This story is told in chronological order over the course of 19 chapters. Is this how you wrote the book?
I did write it chronologically. I also did an amazing amount of editing. I was very fortunate to have a writing partner, a friend named Ilion Wu, author of Master Slave Husband Wife, who was the person who convinced me to do this book in the first place, the person who convinced me that this was a book for a broad audience, and also the person who made me rewrite the first chapter, like, literally 25 times. I mean, she is a ruthless editor, a really wonderful one. The book expanded, it contracted, it changed, things moved around. Above all, courtesy of Ilion, who was wonderful because she compliments like everything that I have trouble with. She's really good at being able to say like, no, or this isn't going to work. So I benefited tremendously from her, and then I benefited tremendously from my editors at HarperCollins, Peter Hubbard and Jessica Vestuto. They were also really wonderful at a later stage. But the big surgery was done by Ilion.
You dedicate this book to Ilion Wu, so tell me just a little bit more about your relationship with her.
It's been so wonderful because, you know, before this, I always sort of thought writing is this very solitary activity. Like, you're there with your computer by yourself. Maybe this is also partly my background as a journalist. Like, writing is a very competitive activity. Who gets the byline? Whose thing is on the front page? And one of the great things about having worked with a writing partner now for something like 9 years is I think both of these truisms are wrong, with the right person at any rate. So when it started, Ilion and I lived in the same neighborhood in New York, and we both had little kids and not enough time, and we both wanted to write. And Ilion turned to me one day and was like, would you be my writing partner? And I was like, sure, because, like, why not, right? And she's like, so I need someone that, like, they're going to commit to writing every day. I'm going to commit to writing every day. We're going to text each other when we're done. And we're going to talk about our writing every couple weeks. And it was this amazing godsend, because you had accountability, you had support. And then we started reading each other's stuff. And, you know, she was wonderful because she's a writer and I'm an academic. So there was a lot I had to purge. I think she made me cut every single sentence that started scholars say, blah, blah, blah. Super helpful. And on the other hand, Ilion, she has this challenge because she loves research and she loves archives. And she never wants to lose anything that she's found in an archive. And so she would make what we referred to as the stuffed sausage, which is like she would stuff her chapters full of these facts. And I'd be like, no, enough. Because I hadn't done the research. So I was like, you can cut this. This doesn't need to be here. As I said, it was really complimentary. And, you know, we've been with each other every step of the way. It's been an amazing journey.
How long did it take you to write this book?
It took a while. I think I signed the contract in 2018, spring of 2018, but I had been working on it. Like, I had been thinking about it and kind of digesting and contemplating for a couple of years, writing a book proposal, etc. And, you know, now it's 2024. So I probably would have been a little faster without the pandemic, but I also have a day job, so.
How did your previous books on Hellenistic, Roman, and Greek sculpture inform the writing of this one?
They both taught me things I wanted to do and also maybe things that I wanted to do differently. In both of them, I worked with archaeological evidence and literary evidence in a really integrative fashion. In both of them, a central theme is kind of the place of Greece within a broader, globally interconnected world. And that's something that Alexander is treating in a similar way. So in those ways, I think they were good preparation. And they just trained me in how to work with a lot of material and come up with a way to tell a story. But there were also lots of things that are very different about academic writing. They were both for Cambridge University Press and very academic. And, you know, this book really had to be a story, had to be something where you really understood the characters and felt like you got a sense of them. And on the other hand, you also had to be kind of bolder in certain ways. Like, you couldn't just hide behind, well, this is this evidence and this is this evidence. You had to kind of go out and say, here's how it worked. As an academic, it took some work to try and figure out how to become this different kind of writer that was speaking to a broader audience. But it's also fun. I think that I feel very grateful to work at CUNY, which has a real value for public scholarship. And I feel like I learned a lot from talking about this material with my students. But I also feel like there were things where I was like, okay, now I have to take a lot of what I know and just kind of bracket it, let it go.
Now that you've written two academic books and one for commercial press, what do you prefer?
They were both wonderful. Both the books I did for Cambridge and this one have been wonderful in different ways. I think I'll probably continue to do something of both. It may be more, I mean, I've written a number of academic articles while I was writing this book, and it may be that I do that and then do commercial books. Yeah, I have this idea for a book on the ancient Mediterranean diet next with lots of archaeological evidence, so we'll see where that goes.
How do you combat the hours of sitting, doing research, and writing? So what do you do for self-care?
I do a number of things because I've never been really good at sitting. I've always been a runner. I love running. I also, during the pandemic, took up bird watching. I'm super nerdy. And so bird watching was great. I'm a gardener and take care of my co-op's garden. I think Alexander would approve. He was very into like lots of physical exertion. So seems appropriate, really.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Rachel Kauser about her book, Alexander at the End of the World, The Forgotten Final Years of Alexander the Great. It was published by Mariner Books in July 2024. This interview was recorded in New York City on May 2nd, 2024. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. Alani Hodge created our theme music. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Have a great week.